from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The social media giant Facebook is rolling out some major changes to its users' news feeds, changes that prioritize posts from friends and family over posts from the media, nonprofits, and businesses. Facebook chief Mark Zuckerberg says he's making the changes to bring people closer together and improve users' well-being and happiness as they engage with the site. But publishers are not feeling so happy. They say the changes will severely curtail their ability to distribute information to their audiences and subscribers, and may even encourage the proliferation of fake news. We'll talk about the changes in store for Facebook users. It's all coming up after this. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The social media giant Facebook has begun implementing changes to users' news feeds that prioritize posts from friends and family over those from news organizations and businesses. The Menlo Park-based company says its new algorithm, which also elevates posts that generate the most engagement, will give users a more positive experience. But media companies, nonprofits, and businesses that rely on Facebook to distribute information worry they'll lose their audiences. This hour, we'll discuss what the changes will mean for users and publishers. And joining me in studio are Mike Isaac. He's technology reporter with the New York Times. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have our own Carly Severin, who's also here with us, senior social media strategist with KQED. Good
morning, Carly. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you as well, and glad to have John Battelle, who's here as well. He's editor-in-chief and CEO of NewCo, which is a San Francisco-based media company. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have all of you. And let me begin, Mike Isaac, with you. So there's algorithms, there's psychological research, there's all kinds of things. And there's also maybe a fear of being under more investigation and more regulations.
That's right. So this, I would say, 2018 is Facebook starting off the year with a sort of apology tour for 2017. You know, they spent the last year under great attack for, you know, what role, if any, it played in the 2016 election outcome. And now they're starting to see dialogue around how people actually are getting sort of fatigued with the amount of stuff that's coming out them through social media, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, the types of negative news, and just sort of like walking away from Facebook, just not feeling good.
And dare we say fake news and extremist kind of news and so forth?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, now when you see a news story pop up in your feed, it's not really sort of like, okay, this is news. It's more a question of, is this actually real, or is this coming from a foreign agent in Russia or some other government? So last week, they basically did this very big rollout, and I went down to Menlo Park and talked to Mark Zuckerberg, and they're making the biggest change to their algorithm, I think probably in at least a few years, if not their history, where what they're trying to do is emphasize something called meaningful interactions. And it sounds kind of, you know, like corporate speak, and it basically is corporate speak.
Sounds a little bit maybe like psychobabble to
me. their whole I think basically they're saying they want to get back to where when you go to Facebook, you can talk to your mom or dad or your friends or people, actual humans that you're connected to on Facebook, rather than get a sort of deluge of articles from the New York Times, or, you know, videos from YouTube or Facebook's own videos, just sort of a lot of the media content that is really fighting for everyone's attention on Facebook now.
Now, you said you spoke to Mark Zuckerberg. What does he say to the charge that they, I mean, at first he was pretty dismissive when they said, you know, this is having a strong impact on the election, all kinds of extremism is going out there and so forth.
Yeah.
Again, he was talking love and connection and all of that. you say he's rolling this out, but how much of this has to do really with the fact that they've come under such scrutiny and regulation?
I think a lot of the moves that you're seeing right now are really to preempt any passage of bills that may come across. You know, at the end of 2017, Facebook, as well as Twitter and Google, had to send people to Congress to testify about the ads that were coming up planted by Russia and sort of Russian hacking groups. And so, you know, they were really caught off guard. They didn't actually have a real handle on the amount of fake news and Russian ads that were going through the network in 2016. So now their whole point is, okay, let's get ahead of it. Let's say we're trying to actually make product changes to handle this stuff. And that's, you know, that's part of why they're saying, look, news, we're going to downgrade or sort of de-emphasize news inside of the news feed and get back to the normal, you know, humans that you and I know on the network. And I don't know if it'll actually work, but it's their sort of charm offensive right now, at least in the public.
Again, Mike Isaac here with us is technology reporter for the New York Times, and Carly Severin's senior social media strategist with KQED. This has some pretty far-reaching economic effects on the news business, for one.
It does. I am part of a pretty large community of social media managers that definitely had some thoughts about this announcement. There was definitely a lot of chatter going on when this came out. And there were actually, it felt like two announcements. There was one from Mark Zuckerberg, which was very focused on what this meant for the users of Facebook. And then there was one from Adam Mosseri, who runs the newsfeed, which was quite specifically targeted to page publishers like us. And the fact is, you're going to see more from personal folks. You're going to see more of your mum's photos, your sister's, your niece, your neighbors, and you're going to see less from publishers like us. So given that Facebook drives an undeniably large portion of traffic to sites like kqed.org, this has to have pretty far-reaching implications.
There was also a big pivot on videos, and now videos are going to be affected by this as well because there won't be as many of them, presumably. But Mark Zuckerberg says people are going to spend more time probably on Facebook, but more valuable time. And I don't know how one provides a metric for that. It's likely to be less time, isn't it?
This is the thing, and there was some interesting language around passive consumption that a lot of us noticed in the announcement. I think especially in Mark Zuckerberg's announcement, talking about passively consuming videos, passively watching, but also passively reading news articles. And that's a very interesting concept, really, that when you consume a piece of news, albeit via Facebook, you're being passive about it. I think a lot of folks would have feelings about
that. A lot of
people
would be very exercised by the news, and, you know, not only in terms of volatility, but also passion and anger and happiness, and because there's some good news, of course, that comes across. It may be a concept that needs some serious, greater, profound examination.
I think so. The good thing about like an organization like Facebook and our news peers in this industry is that we have always kind of been in the engagement business. They're talking about, you know, increasing engagement, sparking dialogue. I mean, we've been doing that for absolutely years. But the interesting thing about this announcement, I guess, is that it's privileging interactions between friends. And when we post news articles to Facebook that people click on, they share, they like, they comment, these aren't necessarily friends talking to each other. It's often strangers who are kind of being linked by these debates, and the idea that that's suddenly not meaningful anymore is interesting, to say the least.
But there can be, indeed probably will be, a number of people who will simply send out these news articles through whomever their Facebook friends might be, and they will go forward.
I think so. I mean, something that people can always do is go to our site, you know, and if you want to share something you find there, you can share it to your own personal social networks, not just Facebook. You can share to Twitter. There are many ways that people can keep almost kind of feeding their news feed with news. I think it's really important to remember that the news in newsfeed did not always mean hard news. That used to mean news from your friends and family. I mean, I remember back in, I think it was definitely pre-2011 when pages were allowed on the network. This was a big deal that suddenly publishers and newspapers and, you know, brands could talk directly to millions of people.
Again, Carly Severin with us in studio, senior social media strategist with KQED. And John Battelle is also here with us in studio. He's founder and editor-in-chief of NewCo, which is a San Francisco-based media company. Talking about the economic effect of this, John, I mean, it's not only on the news business, and there have already been a number of layoffs, but we're talking also about nonprofits, small businesses, and publishers.
Yeah. I think the struggle publishers in particular and brands, they both have a similar struggle. Have with Facebook is that Facebook has a near monopoly on the attention of people online. And so the idea that the engagement of those people belongs to the brand or the publisher has been challenged by Facebook. So when people engage with a KQED news story, who owns that engagement? Does KQED or does Facebook? I think, you know, over the years, we've all learned that, in fact, Facebook owns that engagement. So when Facebook sort of makes a decision that they're going to change the rules of that engagement, you realize that perhaps the best strategy as a business or a brand is not to build your presence on Facebook, but to use that as one of many channels to build a true community off of Facebook. And I think that that is a fundamental question that ladders up to the question of our democratic society. Where is that engagement? Who is responsible for this feed of news? Should one company be responsible for that feed of news? Or should we perhaps take a look at other approaches to building a democratic society?
And when they started moving in this direction, I mean, this has been a trajectory for a couple of years now, we were asking the question, who's making these decisions? I mean, they hire these young, bright people
right.
out of Harvard and Yale and so forth. But they're making the decision about what news is going to be funneled through?
Yeah. Well, this is a question that we're facing, you know, across the board with a lot of other algorithmically driven companies such as Google, Twitter, even Snapchat, which is, you know, these decisions are being made. There's a dodge that the Valley has used for many years, which is the algorithmic dodge. We're not making a decision. We've built this beautiful set of algorithms that make the decision for you based on information you've given us and preferences you've indicated and, you know, latent and direct, you know, information and choices you've made.
And that includes bait clicks.
Absolutely. So if people are now starting to liken this to sort of the early days of the auto industry, the early days of the processed food industry, when we realize we make choices based on almost biological evolution, not necessarily because we're making intellectual choices that might be the best for us. So we often click on stories that are frankly bad for us, and we share stories that are bad for us. And the question is, who's responsible for the welfare of our public good of our society? And to think that one company in Silicon Valley should shoulder that responsibility, to my mind, is a bit insane.
Or Mark Zuckerberg, who says this is good for, you know, the people,
yeah, the
make that decision. But I want to get to something else here, kind of another slant to this, because I was reading some thoughts in The Guardian about Franklin Foer and others who say maybe this is good for the media. They'll face the reality of digital advertising and the ever-growing web traffic, and that's not a bad thing because they won't sustain the industry, especially if the traffic comes.
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a lot of argument from a lot of publishers, and perhaps it's defensive, saying this might long-term be good. In the publishing business, which I've been in for 3 decades now, there used to be a term called junk circulation, where you essentially would buy readers who really didn't care about your publication, but it would inflate the size of your publication, and therefore you could charge higher advertising rates. Facebook has been a source of a lot of junk circulation for the media business over the past 5 years, and this is something of a correction for them.
Let me invite our listeners to join this discussion. In fact, we would like to hear from you. Your thoughts about this and any questions or comments you might have are indeed welcome. And you can join us at our toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Please feel free to be part of the program. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us again toll-free, and please feel free to do so. 866-733-6786. Number of other ways to join the program. Of course, you can go to the Facebook page and post questions or comments there. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our website and post questions or comments there. It's kqed.org/forum. Let me go back to you, Mike Isaac, because we are actually seeing some action. Isn't Facebook going back to Capitol Hill?
Yeah, that's right. So I believe
Facebook
they,
and Google and
probably Twitter too. Yeah, so I think they're testifying in front of the Commerce Committee. The Senate Commerce Committee. I mean, you know, they're going to keep sort of saying there are a few arguments that they made at the end of last year. Facebook's big thing is they don't want to get into the business of censoring the content itself. They feel like it's sort of dangerous to be the arbiter of what is and is not allowed to be shared on the platform. But at the same time, they realize they have this, you know, fake news problem. So what they're doing is saying, we want you to authentically represent yourself, which means if you, Michael Krasny, are going to go on to our platform, you have to be yourself there, and you have to say, this is who I am. And that's their sort of idea of handling fake news. Now, I don't know how far that's going to work. I think there are a lot of other problems there because there, if you go into different countries or different markets, sometimes the source or the authority can be the government or can be sort of dissenters, and Facebook gets into a whole other complicated thing where they have to decide who's allowed to distribute that information. And you know, they're essentially stumbling into countries where they have no idea how the local politics work. So
well, that brings up another important question. Carly, let me go to you on this. I mean, Facebook may be wanting to get into the Chinese market more with this. I mean, to some extent, they've been limited by what they can do in China because China has such strong censorial rules.
I think it's always helpful for folks who do my kind of work in this kind of industry to remember that Facebook's focus is always going to be on the personal users. I mean, it's very tempting to be lulled into that sense of false sense of security that it's a publishing platform now. You know, it cares. It wants to help us put out our news. That has never been the case, and we've always been quite pragmatic about this. Facebook's goal is expansion. It wants more personal users. So the idea that they can go into new markets, I think, makes a ton of sense.
Well, let me go back to you, John Battelle, because there were, by some estimates, about 126 million who were reached by Facebook with Russian bots and all kinds of propaganda of one sort or another that we don't even know about other countries.
No, we have very limited transparency into what Facebook actually knows, and that's actually what frustrates Congress the most in the United States. Is the first number was only $100,000 worth of ads. The second number was, you know, just a few million people saw those ads. The third number was, oh, it's 126 million. And we actually don't know about, as you point out, Michael, all the other actors who did dark pages and various other things. And this gets to the root of the problem. And this is something that I've been pointing out a lot lately. The root of the problem with Facebook has nothing to do actually with what we've been discussing. It has to do with the advertising model that drives that company. And you'll notice in the comments that they've made in the last week or two, they've never mentioned their advertising model. But that is the thing that drives that business, is the ability for anybody to pick anyone else and deliver a message pinpointed directly to them. That's what drove this problem with fake news and with, you know, Russian bots and all of that. And that's the core business model that's making $15 or $16 billion in profit for Facebook last year. They don't want to touch that golden goose. So they're focusing on the problem from the point of view of the newsfeed as a product, not from the point of view as a newsfeed as a river of inventory that advertisers can use to manipulate and persuade people. Because if they actually admit there's a problem there, their stock's not going to go down 5% or 10%. Their stock's going to go down 50%.
But all this talk about being nice and good and bringing families closer together, I mean, you know, there will be a hit for them. There will be an economic hit.
There really should be. They haven't mentioned it, and it's interesting that they haven't mentioned it. When they said earlier that they understand and agree that there is a problem with fake news, they said they were going to hire 3,000 people to be content moderators, and that would hurt their profits. They acknowledged a profit hit when they announced that. This time they did not, and I think it's because advertisers desperately need this, you know, the news feed and the ability to drive their messages into that, you know, attention stream, and they will pay more if they have to pay more to have less reach, as long as that reach is guaranteed by Facebook to be the right people and in the right context.
But here's an interesting fact, and news articles, any of you can comment on this, have actually declined in the second half of 2017. I mean, before this announcement, they were on the decline.
Hmm.
Carly?
Well, I think it's important to note that Facebook has been tweaking its algorithm all the time. This is not some sweeping, unprecedented change. It's been doing this for years. And I think the march to start privileging personal profiles over publisher posts, like ones from KQED and other news organizations, I think that started to happen like back in 2016. You know, we have been anticipating this reaching fever pitch for quite a while. And I think that I'm never sure how many people know this, but just because you like or follow a page or a person or a brand on Facebook, you're not seeing 100% of everything that they post.
Yep.
You're barely seeing a fraction of it. So the job for someone like me and the team I work with is kind of this daily uphill battle against an algorithm that does prevent everyone from seeing your posts. That's just a fact.
Well, we should mention that we're discussing the changes to Facebook and the news feed and many other things here in this hour. We did invite representatives from Facebook. They declined to be part of this discussion, but we have Mike Isaac with us from The New York Times and Carly Severin from KQED and John Battelle from News Co. And we'll get – as we're coming up on a break here, let's see if we can get a caller in here. Let me go first to you. Carrie, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Besides keeping up with people, I use my Facebook page for political activity and sharing ideas and news articles, and I'm concerned about my ability to get to those news articles now and to share information with other people.
You should be concerned, right, Mike Isaac? I mean, news consumers ought to be concerned about this.
Yeah, I think so you're definitely going to start – I've actually started seeing less just hard news stories or any news stories already in my news feed, and I think you're going to start noticing that probably – definitely in America at first and then globally over the next few weeks. It's not going to prohibit you from still sharing your own news links. So if you come across articles, you know, outside of Facebook and want to discuss them with your friends, that actually might get shown to other people just because there are comments back and forth between you and your friends, and they've sort of hinted at some of the things that might make things more visible. They haven't really laid it bare. But I think as far as opening up your Facebook app or on your desktop and immediately coming across news, that's just not going to happen as much.
Does this sound too harsh? I'm going to reference again that Guardian article I read. They said this journalism is going to deprioritize for fluffier stuff.
Well, I think actually that's fair if what friends and family are sharing is fluffy or considered fluffy. And I think what we're really running into here is the idea of a, frankly, paternalistic feed where decisions are made for you as to what they think you should see.
Or what they think should make you feel good.
Should make you feel good, right? And what's that subjective term? Who knows what makes one person feel good against another person versus this idea that the individual is responsible for their own consumption. That idea has been really tossed to the side by all the feed-driven services, and I think it's going to make a comeback with callers like this who are like, hey, wait a minute, I want to share this. I want to make sure my friends and family see this. There's no way for the caller to do that right now. There's no way to ensure that because, as Carly pointed out, only a fraction of what you shared is ever shown to the people who are your friends or followers.
Yeah, Carly, you wanted to add something here?
Yeah, I should point out that from a practical standpoint, there are a few things you can do to make sure that you still see some of those news posts. If there is a page that you get news from that you really value, you can go to up the top of the page. There's a button that says following. You click on it, and then you'll get the option to see first. You click on that, and that will ensure that you will see at least some of those news posts first in your news feed. So that's one practical step. And it seems that sharing and commenting will keep that stuff in the news feed to some extent. Not sure how much.
Well, you can get around it, that's for sure. But let me just read a comment from Matthew, one of our listeners, who writes, with these new changes, my racist uncle can post something false about immigrants and politicians can still purchase ads that amplify voices like his. The New York Times or KQED can't reach my news feed to tell me that none of it's true. All right. We're going to go to a break here. And again, if you've just joined us, we're talking about Facebook prioritizing posts from family and friends, for family and friends, and from family and friends bearing the news. Mike Isaac with us from the New York Times, Carly Severin from KQED, and John Battelle from NewCo. And you more when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're discussing changes to Facebook news feeds with Mike Isaac, technology reporter with The New York Times, Carly Severin, senior social media strategist with KQED, and John Battelle, founder and editor-in-chief of NewCo. And I should mention that NewCo produces The Shift Forum, an executive conference dissecting the collision of technology, business, politics, and culture, and our divisive political climate. And let me, before I go to calls, read some comments that are coming in here, and there are a lot of them coming in. Mason writes, the people who get their news primarily from Facebook are not critical voters, and I assume most of this group are not voters at all. Forum should focus on consequential topics rather than the Facebook latest tweaks to the its algorithms. I don't think he's right on that, first of all.
Pretty sure there's a lot of people on Facebook who vote.
Yeah, so am I. Another listener writes, Facebook is throwing the baby out with the bathwater here. They are afraid of spreading bogus news, and so will de-emphasize all news. Noel says, have we gotten so lazy as news consumers that we rely on Facebook feed for news? Mm-hmm. There's plenty of reputable news outlets to choose from all over the net. And another listener says, how about discussing the annoying video ads when we are watching? I don't care how interested I am. I shut it down and move on. And Bob says, this action will not change the simple fact that social media was created by kids as a tool to gossip, harass, tribalize, rate and rank others, often done anonymously. The exploitation by corporate and political bad guys was an inevitable result. These platforms bring out the worst in human nature and should be avoided at all costs. It should be regulated like traditional media. And to any of you on this other comment, then I'll go to callers. Bill says, maybe media companies, nonprofits, and businesses shouldn't assume Facebook feels an obligation to be a service to them. Mike Isaac.
Yeah, no, actually, it's really interesting. I think probably 2 or 3 years ago, there was this real internal shift that and Facebook's sort of motto was, Facebook wants to be your daily newspaper. So they actually did feel an obligation to inform the public. You know, Mark Zuckerberg and Chris Cox, who's their sort of SVP of product, had real strong feelings about, you know, journalism is important, informing the public is important, and they saw Facebook as more than what they're sort of positioning it as now, which is a way to deliver a news experience to people. Now they're sort of
going back to their roots.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the way it's being publicized, I think, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's how they're doing. Now they're just saying, okay, clearly there's some pitfalls that we didn't see, so now we're going to go back to what Facebook started as. And as your listener sort of pointed out, they might be throwing out the baby with the bathwater here because, you know, you might be tossing out all of the news that might have actually been reaching people that they wouldn't have otherwise seen.
Well, let's reach some of our listeners and hear from more of them. Let's go to you, Leland. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. I observed in the run-up to the 2016 elections, a lot of these news stories, the comment section, being a site of real people interacting with what I perceive to be bots. And it was pretty obvious that real people were talking to bots, communicating in these comment sections. And I imagine that this drives traffic, and when Facebook eliminates the news feed, is there any addressing of what will become of these fake accounts that sort of proliferated in these comment sections? Or do you think they'll enter some sort of more personal domain like Facebook's trying to make it seem?
Yeah, John, but tell us some thoughts from you.
Well, I think your observations are correct. And all, you know, the major companies, Google, Facebook, Twitter, they employ thousands of people who try to identify these bots and eliminate them. It is far harder than it might seem, not only because identifying them is difficult, but because it's just so easy to create new ones. Mm. So you can kill 1,000 of them and 2,000 bloom in their place. This is a major driver of engagement and traffic on all the platforms. And this is one of the hardest problems that these technology companies have, which is telling who's human, which is kind of an odd thing when you think that Facebook, in fact, is supposedly about real human beings. But it is a problem, and I say in particular Twitter has this problem because it has anonymity built into the platform.
And let me go to a question, important question from Kathleen about maybe the effect this might have on the Mueller investigation. Kathleen, join us.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I was concerned that with Facebook, you said digging deep into getting rid of the current situation, the algorithm that they have, that perhaps it might affect the Mueller investigation or maybe definitely affect it. I don't know, but I'd appreciate some discussion on that. Thank you.
All right, thank you for the question. Who'd like to speculate on that?
I just think that...
It's Mike Isaac.
Yeah, I think the way to look at it is... I don't know if it would necessarily have a direct influence on the investigation itself, but really how we perceive how the investigation is going, right? You know, a lot of what you're seeing right now, too, are attacks on Mueller and sort of ways to discredit him or the investigation, which might legitimize actually firing him. So, again, Facebook doesn't want to get in the business of arbiting what types of things we should or shouldn't see. I mean, you know, whether they are doing that or not. But you know, I don't think it will directly affect the investigation, but maybe how you actually perceive how it's going.
Mm-hmm. And let me go to a question, Carly, let me go to you on this. Joel writes, will the changes you've discussed at Facebook lead to a permanent long-term reduction in the company's influence over what we read? If so, does that mean websites like the New York Times will regain readers they've lost to Facebook?
That's an interesting question. I mean, in my mind, one of the questions is how much people will go out of their way to seek out the news that was being kind of hand-delivered to their door. Mm-hmm. And not just in the morning. You know, we've gotten so out of the kind of ritualized consumption of news that we might have used to have. You know, the nightly news, you turn on the TV, you'd open your paper and read it for 15 minutes at a certain time of day. And now you're getting push notifications, you're scrolling your feed, and there's news about Capitol Hill interspersed with news from your family and your friends and your neighbors. It really has changed how we consume. So I guess my question is, if people aren't seeing as much in Facebook, how are they going to find it? Are they going to visit sites like kqed.org every morning like they might have used to, or the New York Times? I don't know, but I think we're going to find out.
Mm. John Battelle, you think this issue, Jim wants to know, has anything to do or will have anything to do with net neutrality?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Net neutrality was the number one issue for most of these companies 2 or 3 years ago. It's been eclipsed, certainly, by the fake news story and everything we've been discussing. They are related, but I think the way these companies handle the threat of regulation has been markedly different with this particular issue, where they're concerned that there may be some kind of existential regulation. I mean, you're not allowed to deliver personalized ads, because those personalized ads, we can't control them, so therefore they're dangerous. You know, it's leaded gasoline, right? You can't do it. They don't want that kind of regulation to happen. They'd prefer to self-regulate. Whereas with net neutrality, they were very, very concerned that regulations on the books would go away, or that stronger regulations were needed. So there's a very different approach between net neutrality and this. But these issues are certainly linked, because it has to do with freedom of speech.
Well, I'm looking at actually a couple comments here that are apropos. Wendy writes, I share a lot of news and commentary with my friends. I don't want nanny Facebook to determine what I think is important. Is there a way to game the new algorithm?
Well, as I mentioned before, you can click up top where it says following on the pages that you like, and then you can ensure that if you click that little see first button that you will continue to see some of those posts.
Dovetailing on that, Rebecca mm-hmm. says, if you set your preferences to show first your favorite news sites, can that compensate for the algorithm?
It will to some degree. How much, I cannot say, because you're still not going to see 100% of everything that a page like KQED or the New York Times posts.
Let me bring another caller aboard here. Greg, you're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, and thank you for this conversation. I'm with the baby with the bathwater people. I believe that what Facebook is doing is painting with a broad brush. Instead of accepting their ethical responsibility to sort between those companies, those news, quote, and I put news in quotes, organizations that provide fake news from those like the New York Times and the Washington Post and there are others who are legitimate, honest brokers of the news. I think that to say that they're not already doing that is wrong. They have algorithms that do sort between things. They make choices. So they do bear responsibility. This is not a commons owned by everybody. This is a specific piece of software that is owned by Facebook, and they bear responsibility. There was an interesting article, I believe it was in the Washington Post recently, an opinion article by a man who had worked with Zuckerberg early on as a consultant, and he understood the algorithm, and I think his description of it was an algorithm that would seek out those things which were negative and give them heavy weight. And he was very critical, and I think he has brought some lawsuits with some organizations to stop this. They have an ethical responsibility. They're trying to avoid it. Instead of doing the hard work to sort the wheat from the chaff, they're just simply saying, well, we're just going to avoid all that issue.
Yeah, well, I thank you for those comments. Good to hear from you, Greg. And I think Mike Isaac may want to respond to you. But first, I just have to insert one thought here, and that is that a lot of the news is going to be bad. I mean, Bertolt Brecht said it best, the man who laughs has not yet been told the terrible news. I mean, there's a lot of truth behind that statement. Unfortunately, you just pick up the paper and look. So you need an algorithm to tell you that news is going to possibly bring you into a downer, even though you may want that news because you're going out and being politically active, or you're going to do something as a citizen that's going to make a change. I mean, Mike, what are your thoughts?
That's exactly right. I think, you know, it's funny because I talked to Facebook has their own research wing. They literally go out and survey people. They invite them in. They go across the world and ask people how they use Facebook, what they feel about Facebook. And one of their big concerns.
And they have a lot of big heavy hitters in terms of academic psychologists and that sort of thing.
That's right. They hire from the top research institutions in the world. And you know, this sort of brings you back to Facebook is a for-profit corporation because their big concern is if people are leaving Facebook feeling bad, that means that they might not want to come back to Facebook in the future. So their incentive is to change it to make people leave feeling good, which, as you said, like that might not be a reflection of reality right now, you know. So I think I really, really agree with your caller a minute ago. There is a sort of ethical responsibility that they are abdicating and also sort of put it on. They talk about algorithms in the abstract a lot, and that sort of is a way to shift responsibility to this computer that doesn't have emotional decisions that a human would be. But one thing we forget is that these algorithms are made by people, and decisions have to be made in order to get to a point where they decide what's going to be shown.
So let me just remind listeners that in the time remaining, you can join us at 866-733-6786. That's a toll-free number. And here's another point of view. Let me go to you on this, John Battelle. Aaron asks on Facebook, shouldn't your guest be talking about how unique it is for a public company to prioritize its users over its business partners? That seems to be the real story here, and seemingly a long-term strategy rather than the typical short-term what's good for the Wall Street strategy. Isn't this a good thing?
I think that's one argument. I think the question of whether or not they're prioritizing their users over their business partners is an unanswered one. As I pointed out earlier, they have not yet discussed the impact of this move on their actual business. They have a very robust advertising business. As a matter of fact, many marketers who I work with feel handcuffed to Facebook. They don't have a choice but to spend money there. So as Facebook changes their approach, the advertisers will evolve and change their approach as well. I don't know that they're going to stop spending money. As a matter of fact, there's an argument that they may spend more because it's harder to get into the news feed. So you have to spend more money to get in front of the attention of the people that matter to your particular business.
Would it be too cynical to say if they saw their profits declining or going down that they may even charge a steeper amount of money?
No, it's not at all. That's the business of advertising. A higher CPM for a smaller reach is because you have a better composition of people you're trying to target. Facebook, let's be clear, is in the data collection and advertising targeting business. They are not in the kumbaya make the world a better place business. And the shareholders of Facebook are counting on that. And I think it's important that we remember they're a for-profit company. Yes, they're draping this decision in long-term thinking, and I'm glad they're doing that because we need more of that, both in the Valley and across business generally.
And we'll go to another caller and welcome Jamie onto the air. Jamie, you're on.
Hi. My experience is completely different. I actually have a family member that is being blocked. My father, my 81-year-old father, is being blocked because he will not provide an actual photo of himself. He uses random old man photos for his profile picture, and they blocked him, and he found an email after my sister noticed that he wasn't on there, and they told him, you'll be unblocked as long as you show us a photo of your actual self. And my question is, how can they honestly say that they're trying to protect us by blocking a man who hardly ever used Facebook except to see my posts and my sister's posts, but will readily accept rubles and and don't seem to look after harassing posts and things like that? I just I'm confused as to how they're connecting families.
I don't see eagerness to weigh in here from anybody, but your thoughts, my guys, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think you know, first of all, it's I think they're going to mess up a lot of the time just because they have 2 billion people on the platform, and like any sort of consistent response to any one individual case is just never going to happen. But I will say at a sort of high level, their whole point is authenticity of identity, right? So they want you to use your real name. They want you to use like a real photo, I guess, in this case is one of those things. And again,
a lot of photos in there of people much younger than they look.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, like maybe 20, 30 years or something.
But that's their sort of high level guideline, which they don't always abide by. But, you know, that for better or worse, that's how they apply their rule of law.
Mike, let me go back to you on a question from Hunter. He says, does this change mean that fake news will be easier to track as opposed to having fake news being spread automatically to all members of a fake news group? For example, if there's a coordinated effort made by a handful of members of a fake news group and they are spreading the information, wouldn't it be a lot easier to track?
That's a really interesting point. I think so. The concern that I have, or the concern that some people have too, is that if it's easier to track, I also wonder if we sort of cordon off into these more closely knit filter bubbles of our own making, right? So part of the you could say benefit of inserting more news or more of other people, other say brands or whatever, into my newsfeed before was that I would have a multiplicity of views and different viewpoints, and like maybe that's a good thing, right? So if I'm only talking to my family or my friends that maybe share and I self-select to have my point of view, maybe that sort of polarizes us even more rather than encourages more speech across the platform.
Well, one of the big criticisms, let me give you this, Carly, has been consistently that Facebook is too much of an echo chamber. I mean, you get the friends and family who often see things from a similar point of view, and so they just echo each other over and over again.
I do not doubt that that happens. And then on the other side of the coin, I see a lot of vigorous debate on our Facebook pages. We have quite a few here at KQED. People with very opposing opinions, particularly after the election. We saw a greatly heightened kind of quota of debate and often some really strong opinions being exchanged. And I'd often find that the community would come in and self-moderate, which actually is a pretty great thing to see. We've built up this, you know, by and large, a pretty great community on Facebook. I will be very personally sad if a lot of those people are no longer able to see our posts or connect with us. But we are, as I mentioned, we're pretty well placed in that we've always got people talking. There have always been people commenting and sharing and disagreeing with each other.
We like to think that that's what we're doing here without the advertising. I mean, there is occasional underwriting, but that is what we do every day. And we'll get Megan on as our next caller. Megan, join us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Welcome.
My comment is just that one of your guests said that Facebook has an incentive to design for leaving you with a positive feeling because that will motivate you to come back to your feed. And critics like Tristan Harris have said that designing for outrage and addictiveness is actually closer to Facebook's goal. So, you know, showing you things on your feed like fake news that feel outrageous will keep you coming back and back. And also for young kids, you know, the social aspect and the social pressure makes them addicted to these social media platforms. And I know organizations like Common Sense Media have done extensive research on the addictiveness of platforms like Facebook and Snapchat and other social media channels. So how do we address this kind of larger issue? Facebook seems like they're just avoiding this by trying to do a quick change on the feed, but that doesn't get to these underlying issues that Facebook is actually trying to design to keep us on the platform as long as possible. And what keeps us there is not positivity, it's addictiveness and outrage.
Some serious thoughts there. Anybody want to respond?
Tristan's work, actually, I think...
this is Jean Battelle.
One could argue was heavily cribbed for this recent news from Facebook. As a matter of fact, in Mark's post, he used the phrase time well spent, which you might call the equivalent of a dog whistle. I mean, that was... that time well spent is the name of the foundation that Tristan Harris started. After leaving Google, very concerned about the negative externalities that the caller just mentioned. And I think it's good that Facebook has acknowledged and validated this concept of time well spent. But the difficult piece, which we've been debating for the better part of an hour, is how can one company determine what is time well spent? Mm. It's simply too much to ask any company to do, and frankly, too much for any company to presume they can do. I think it's a bit naive for them to think that they could actually determine what's going to make the four of us sitting at this table or all your listeners feel good after a session with Facebook. And there are many dangers to that, including the fact that you will not engage with news that may be negative or difficult or challenging.
There's also something, you know, really arrogant about this, that we can decide for you. I'm Mark Zuckerberg. I'm the CEO of Facebook, the founder, of course.
Precisely, and that certainly is part of a culture that is under attack, the technology culture, right now. I think there's plenty of other models that we can perhaps look at for how we might structure a business like Facebook that allow thousands, if not millions, of flowers to bloom by accessing that set of capabilities they have: identity, data, preferences, interests. It's a powerful set of tools that independent third parties like KQED can convene communities. Now, Mark did say community is going to be the center of his push. I think what he may determine is that Facebook's bad at making community, but organizations like KQED are good at it.
And I will say, from my host position here, this is an open invitation to Mark Zuckerberg, who has never been on this program. We've had his sister on, in fact, when she wrote a book, and she actually sang a cappella on this program.
I remember.
She's admitted in her book that she would have loved to have been a Broadway singer. She had a pretty good voice, actually. So I said, go ahead, sing. And she can sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Some comments. A Facebook comment from Rebecca. Well, no, actually, let me go to this. From Kyle, who says, if news feeds change, wouldn't this be beneficial? So many of my friends on the site do not fully read but do share false or debunked news. Shouldn't we have trusted, authorized news on the platform once verified as truthful?
Yeah, I think that is, again, this sort of and actually over the past, I would say, the year, Facebook has done a few experiments in the vein of like putting little product tweaks that say this source might not be trusted or that this sort of source is in dispute. And one of the interesting things they found is after they added those product tweaks, people tend to read those stories even more, that, which might have piqued their curiosity as to, you know, like, oh, well, if this is a fake news story, maybe I want to read it, which is, I think, baffled them. It definitely, you know, it's just sort of says something about human behavior in general. They're now retreating from that sort of thing and again, trying to get away from the idea of saying this is the right thing or the wrong thing you should read. And again, that's part of probably preempting any sort of regulation or being treated as TV or radio would. But it's just funny to see them kind of test and move back and forth. And I think, like we've been talking about, you know, a full retreat seems to be their answer, at least for right now.
And Carly Severin, Janine writes, it's inherently problematic when people rely on Facebook for news anyway. It's an incomplete daily news reading habit. It is our responsibility to keep ourselves informed, not Facebook's obligation to put news in front of us.
I would definitely encourage folks to apply the same level of rigor to stuff they read on Facebook, to the stuff that they read or hear or watch in other aspects of their lives. And I do feel like, you know, our audiences, they are smart people. They are already doing that. But, you know, on a certain platform, when news is being, you know, hand-delivered to you, it is very easy to just consume. And I would always encourage people to ask questions of what it is they're reading. But one point I did want to make about the announcements that came out of Facebook about this change, for those reading them closely, there were some really interesting redefinitions of what community is, what engagement is, and also kind of what news is as well, and the idea that a piece of news is more meaningful, more valuable, will rise further in the news feed because people are talking about it. And there was a really interesting article by Joshua Benton for Nieman Lab that said that's actually kind of a profound ideological statement, the idea that this is now how we're measuring value in our news because people are commenting about it and liking it and sharing it. And so when folks are reading news on Facebook, I would encourage them to wonder what they're getting from it and to take their own value from it, to click, to read, to comment if they should so wish. And I guess we'll figure it out from there.
Well, here's another comment that's apropos. Marjorie writes, when Facebook prioritizes sharing among friends, it would seem to exacerbate the bubble impacts. I find it mind-boggling that there are such large pockets of people who operate on a dramatically different frame of reference than I do. I think Facebook would make the impact worse, as it would further overemphasize my friends. And a question for you, if I may, John Battelle, it's directed to you. He says, Russ writes, you were a co-founder of Wired magazine in the early 90s. Looking back, what today about the state of technology and its impact on society and culture would surprise you? Are you less optimistic now than you were then?
I haven't lost my optimism. But
congratulations.
In the early days of the, you know, what we called the digital revolution back then, we were convinced that a number of sort of tenets would be proven true. Independence and openness and transparency, we thought, would win the day. And that looked as if it were going to happen in the early aughts when the blogging broke out and it seemed like everyone had a voice. Google was a benevolent monarchy that sort of distributed attention based on us asking an intentional question. I'm interested in news about Afghanistan. Send me to the best place. What's happened since then is we've moved towards a closed system, which Facebook is, a walled garden, that delivers us news, and we don't ask it anything. We sort of we shed data that it hoovers up, and then it tells us what it thinks we might be interested in. That is not a world I saw,
well, I remember,
except as a dystopia, frankly, yeah. when we were launching Wired.
I remember David Weir worked for Wired back in the day, and I remember him showing me. He said, look at this. I mean, we didn't have the language then, but look, this is clickbait. You know, the more responses we get, this is what we have to go in terms of the news. Well, and we have a master of that now in the White House. Thank you all for being a part of this morning's discussion. Appreciate your being with us. Again, John Battelle is founder and editor-in-chief of NewCo, and Carly Severin is senior social media strategist with KQED, and Mike Isaac is technology reporter with The New York Times. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. In the hour ahead, we're going to find out what some folks have done in SF Sketchfest, which is pretty amazing. They've got about 30 musicians together, and they've taken a couple of the scores from big movies by Wes Anderson and simply replicated them. We'll hear about that. We'll actually hear some of the music. We'll also talk with Lauren Eisen, who has written a book about prisons for profits, I think a very important book, and we'll talk about that with her. That's all coming up on Forum, so stay tuned. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.